You know, we all say that Bitcoin is anti-fragile and it's resilient from attacks, right? But is it really like that? I mean, there are so many different kind of attacks, like network attacks, blockchain attacks, legal threats, you know. So we would love to talk about all of these topics today, but it's going to be almost impossible. So I will try to make the best thing and to moderate the panel in the best way. And I would like to start with Jameson. With the ossification topic, and it's a pretty huge topic and hot topic right now. And I would like to ask you if, in your opinion, like premature ossification of the base layer is going to be like a problem and an attack vector in the near future.
It's interesting because, you know, this is not necessarily a direct, obvious attack vector. We were actually talking backstage about, you know, what would be if we were a malicious, say, nation-state entity or whatever, what would be the cheapest and least obvious way of attacking Bitcoin? And I think we generally agree that some type of PSYOP would be, you know, a way of socially attacking. And so I think that the question in my mind is, you know, is there a certain perspective that some people are taking that we must stop developing the protocol because it's not safe to continue to change it? I see this as a very fear-based thing because obviously there are trade-offs. Whenever you make a change, you may enable new functionality that may add value, but you also might unintentionally enable some sort of exploit or backdoor. And so that's generally what I hear people talking about. The flip side of it, and what I've been trying to get across recently, is that we actually have a multi-decade history of observing internet protocols ossifying. I think everybody agrees ossification is almost a problem of physics in the sense that you have a network protocol that it continues to expand in adoption until eventually that network of protocol users gets crushed under its own weight, and it becomes really impossible to coordinate upgrades because they're just it's too dispersed and there's no one who owns it, no one who centrally coordinates it. But point being that the internet protocols that many of us use today that are essentially ossified, there's plenty that could be done to improve them. Of course, it's not possible to improve them anymore, but they didn't stop changing because people made a conscious decision not to do that. I think that it's worthy of our time as developers to continue to push forward to try to improve Bitcoin as much as we possibly can, because we know there will become a point in time in which we can no longer do that. And we also know that even if a protocol ossifies, the world does not ossify around it, and new unanticipated things can come up which you need solutions for. And what we've seen is kind of hacky solutions, usually hacky centralized solutions, come up to address issues in other internet protocols. I usually talk about email because I spent a decade working on that, but email is a very terrible history of centralization and hacky solutions bolted on, which has resulted in email becoming highly centralized.
Do you want to add something, Andrew?
The question was, what would I do if I would be a state-level actor to destroy Bitcoin, right? I would do it slowly and first of all, I would limit Bitcoin liquidity by making centralized exchanges very expensive to run. Then I will poison Bitcoin development by making it very inconvenient to not even commit any changes to Bitcoin repository, but even to discuss any changes. Then I will spread thought about how mining kills the planet, tax it into oblivion, make mining licensed activity, and then I would like to control manufacturing of ASICs, basically to limit access to them just to actors that would support my view of Bitcoin. And if somebody would decide to oppose it, I would just physically destroy them.
Peter?
Well, I mean, I was involved in what, could have been an attack on Bitcoin in the block size debates. And, in terms of ossification, I would actually make the opposite point, where a lack of ossification is a very big concern. Because, a protocol that keeps on changing is a protocol that you can go and apply pressure to change in the way you want to. And every single time it changes, that's another opportunity to apply pressure in a way that may not be in the interest of people using the protocol. And the beautiful thing about what we have with Bitcoin right now is I think it's ossified to a large extent. How we use Bitcoin at the base layer is pretty stable. Doesn't look like it's going to change very much in the foreseeable future. And then you build layers on top of it like Lightning, where it's okay if you and I have a Lightning channel or, use Lightning in a way that's different than, those two dudes there. That's okay. We can still go back to Bitcoin and move value around later and move it back up to this new system. And we can experiment with completely new things on the side, too. And that gives you much better competition, much better ability to experiment. And this is why, my professional life, I did do one change to Bitcoin's consensus, which is off check lock from verify. It's very boring. But basically all my effort has been on figuring out how do you go and use the protocol as is to do interesting things without having to coordinate with other people.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's like pressure from coming from outside, like an external pressure regarding ossification, or like a political pressure?
Well, I think the block size debate was an example of pressure to change Bitcoin for the worse. I look at it this way. If in 20 years they declassified a bunch of NSA documents and it turned out half those people were NSA operatives, I would not be surprised. And there are examples of protocols in the past where this has turned out to be true. Now, is that necessarily true? Well, we don't really know. But it certainly was a force to make Bitcoin worse. And it's something many other coins have gone through as well. And we're just lucky we navigated that in a way that led us to something better. Is Lightning perfect? No, but it's better than the alternative.
You want to add? Peter, still regarding pressure, and in specific pressure to developers and legal threats to developers. So we all know that things are changing in the last years, right? So what do you think about legal threats and pressure on developers, maybe like public developers like you, where you have your full name and surname?
Well,
and you can be attacked,
of course,
on the legal side by malicious entities from various countries and jurisdictions over the world.
I am one of on the order of like 15 people or so involved in different aspects to Bitcoin and Bitcoin development, who of course is being sued by Craig Wright. And that's actually, for me personally, two separate lawsuits with ludicrous billions of dollars claimed in damages and all this nonsense. But that's certainly something like we're very glad that people are helping with. But maybe even a more concerning example is more like the Tornado Cash dev, who of course he's in jail right now, or may have been bailed
just
out.
Got out,
yeah, just got bailed out from a crow. Yeah, you're right. And he has very serious charges against him for what appears to be a charge of essentially writing open source software. And of course, due to the way the Dutch legal system works, he doesn't actually technically have charges against him yet, which is its own level of ridiculous. But you can see this kind of thing happening. And I think the real challenging part is that going anonymous is not the solution to this. Going pseudonymous is not the solution to this. You need, for a project like Bitcoin, for an ecosystem like Bitcoin, you need devs who are able to go on stage and talk to people, and to be able to create that community and gather together and, teach people how stuff works. You need people who are able to do that. And if all you have is pseudo-anonymous devs, both you don't have that community, but also, how do you know who those people are? I mean, bootstrapping trust is really difficult. Pure pseudonymous devs, it's very easy for those kinds of groups to get taken over by bad actors. It's much less likely, or at least much harder, to pull off that same kind of thing with devs who are not anonymous. And while, there's threats in both models, I think we're far better off if we can have a mix of both. And unfortunately, to do that, we really need to go fight governments and other bad actors in the legal system. There's no getting around that, because pseudonymity is not the magic solution.
Imagine that you have a time travel machine right now. Would you go back in the past and change something and change like how you approach it to Bitcoin and contribute it to Bitcoin?
Absolutely not. In fact, I consciously made that decision way back in 2012 or something when I first got involved in this under my own name, because I thought very hard, do I want to do this under my own name or a pseudonym? Mm-hmm. And for me personally, the decision was basically, I like being out in public. I like speaking to people. I'm reasonably good at it, probably better than the average dev. So I should be the sort of person who takes that risk, because people are good at different things. I happen to be better at that side of it, so I might as well take that risk. It's the right thing to do, and I would not change that decision one bit.
For the record, I tried really hard to get Craig Wright to sue me, and he threatened many times, but he always backed off. But yeah, I mean, this is somewhat a problem with anyone who becomes a public persona. Anyone who contributes to open source development has a potential for this to become a problem if their project takes off and becomes big enough. And I mean, open source development is certainly an adversarial environment. I think for most open source projects, the adversarial nature is very limited to just a small number of contributors. Yeah. But when you have a project that ends up being adopted by millions of people, you just have a lot more eyeballs, and as a result, more bad actors or more people who are just willing to do nasty things.
I would like to add something. I appreciate your strategy of fighting legal battles, but you are from Western democracies, and you are convinced that you can win legal battles. I have seen a lot of legal cases in my country and in Russia, and I guess that you haven't seen cases when a state is really against you. Just imagine, you would like to sue state in a state court. And if there would be a real decision to make you liable, judge will just stamp the correct decision that was given them from above. So
I hate to say it, but like part of the advice kind of has to be, in some cases, you just have to go move to a better country.
Yes, but at one day, there will be no more countries to move. So
if we get to that point, we're just screwed. Bitcoin is not magic.
But you can't stop at this point. You have
I don't agree with you. I'm more hopeful.
Okay, let's change the topic. So right now, another hot topic is like the possibility of having backdoors inside hardware wallets. I'm pretty sure that like most of the people are using hardware wallets nowadays because they trust them more than their own computer, right? It can be risky to trust a black box, even if you have like an open source firmware or software, but still you have like a piece of hardware that you don't really know what happened when you bought it, when someone sent it to you, and maybe even when you let it at home, right? You know, evil-made attacks and supply chain attacks are real. So is it a real threat, like the possibility of having a backdoor in a hardware wallet? Or can we like minimize or reduce the risks of using hardware wallets by, for example, generating our own entropy, letting them offline all the time? So, I mean, what's your point of view about like attacking hardware wallet and hardware wallet companies?
It's certainly possible. I think in general, we talk about security, usually you want to be paranoid and go to the extreme end of what could a well-funded nation-state attacker do. Mm-hmm. And so, from the perspective that probably the vast majority of the hardware devices out there are created by only a handful of companies, thankfully these companies are generally in different countries, but I think they're mostly in Western and EU countries that tend to work together on various things. Then, there are potential points of failure. I mean, and even being open source, it's not like security panacea. It's still quite possible to slip in code that is, the average open source developer can look at the code and not tell that it's malicious. I mean, there are entire competitions around like subversive programming of malicious code. So yeah, I mean, there is no perfect security solution. How could we get around that? I am a big fan of air-gapped machines. I'm actually a big fan of the various hardware devices that only transfer data, you know, either, you know, over like an SD card or over animated QR codes. If you're transferring the data, if you're plugging in over USB, you can't really be totally sure that no data is being exfiltrated. At least, you know, the average person isn't going to be able to tell what's happening there. So yeah, I mean, black boxes are generally bad. Open source isn't perfect. It's certainly better, or at least it makes it more likely that some eyeballs will catch the problem. So, you know, this is unfortunately just the fact that there is no perfect security solutions. It's trade-offs all the way down. But if you're using a hardware device, you're already better off than the vast majority of people.
Peter, I know that you are a huge QSOS fan, a user.
Well, I mean, I don't, for the most part, I don't use hardware devices at all. Or I should say hardware wallets, to be precise. You know, when I've been in situations where I've needed to store a large amount of Bitcoin securely, I've done things like, say, buy a used laptop, preferably one a few years old, wipe the system and go install Linux on it from, you know, a source that I can at least trace back and have reasonable trust in, and then put, you know, something like, say, Bitcoin Core on it. Because the big problem with hardware wallets is your whole supply chain leading up to the point where you receive that hardware wallet. Every step in that supply chain is touching a device that they know will be used to store Bitcoin. And that's a very big target. Now, the security posture of hardware wallets is very different than, say, a laptop, which is why with multisig, hardware wallets can absolutely be useful. You know, using hardware wallets in addition to a key kept on, say, a laptop you go keep on a safe and don't otherwise use. But, you know, in single key environments where the thing that processes that key and signs those transactions has full control of where the money goes, I don't trust hardware wallets. Like, they're just, they add so many supply chain risks that do not exist. And the simpler and easier version of just get a computer or, you know, get a phone and only use it for that one thing. Now, in the future, like I say, I think this will change with multisig, but the software ecosystem, you know, has only very recently gotten to the point where any of that's practical. And of course, in reality too, I mean, I run Lightning nodes, which have a reasonable amount of money on them. In those cases, well, you know, it's Lightning. You just kind of got to cross your fingers and hope right now because nobody has Lightning multisig. But I'm not too worried. And, you know, I've never been in a position where I've lost money due to hacks. But, you know, I do things like I use cubes, which splits up my computer into many different virtual machines. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I use computers is just much more secure than the average person. And that really says something about how terrible computer security has been in general, you know, and the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, we don't want to go down that rabbit hole because we'll scare everybody in the audience because, yeah, the, regardless of what solution you're using, you know, if it's an air-gapped laptop or if it's one of the big manufacturers, I mean, almost nobody has the ability to fully verify that entire hardware and software stack. So like Peter was saying, like the only way you can kind of get around that is, you know, additive security of just like using a diversity of different key mechanisms. And then, you know, being okay with one or two of them having flaws and potentially failing.
I should point out the security of being untargetable. And, you know, a really funny example of this is, like, I personally reviewed security protocols for things like exchanges, which are storing, you know, many, many, many millions of dollars of worth of Bitcoin. And when they're doing their job right, often the protocol starts with something that sounds ludicrous, like, go to the local computer store and just get a laptop off the shelf at random. But bizarrely, that could be more secure than ordering something from a secure manufacturer because that creates a target. And yeah, we know for a fact in the past, and probably they still do, entities like the NSA have intercepted packages and put backdoors in there. You know, Snowden leaked this, and we have photos of Cisco routers getting opened by NSA operatives. That is a very real risk. And unfortunately, there isn't a good answer to that risk other than things like randomization, making sure that you're getting stuff from stocks where they just don't know in advance what it's being used for. hardware wallets are definitely not that.
With hardware security, we are right now in a situation that looks like with software before, say, 1993 or 5, before Linux kernel was created and open source operating system started to become popular. Until you can't yourself verify what is going on with your hardware, you are out of luck. You just can increase, well, decrease probability of getting hacked, but you can't be sure. And unfortunately, with current technology of chip manufacturer, you have no chance because, well, you can't invest how many? Tens, billions of dollars to create your own fab just to manufacture one or a dozen of chips.
So Peter mentioned supply chains. And I mean, supply chains are just terribly fragile and insecure and not verifiable. But not only hardware supply chains, but software supply chains. And this is actually something that I've started to understand better in recent years, is the fragility of especially things like library package management and dependencies, and actually a lot of the tooling that has helped us really accelerate development as software engineers, because we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We let other people do a lot of the heavy lifting, and then we put all the pieces of the puzzle together. But unfortunately, this becomes a huge attack vector as well, because many times these software packages become unmaintained and get taken over by attackers who insert malicious code. Or Peter actually had a really good point backstage where, you know, probably some of the biggest attack vectors, not just for Bitcoin, but for all of human society, is like Microsoft, Apple, yep, and Google, because they own the supply chains for what probably the vast majority of computing devices that are used by humans on this planet.
Not the vast majority of servers, because they tend to run Linux.
Yeah.
But of consumer stuff, absolutely. And, you know, and I want to further that point by saying, from the point of view of developers, you know, in some cases, we're going backwards on that. Like PGP usage is going down. I mean, just other, you know, I happen to maintain the Python library, Python Bitcoin Lib. And just the other day, the Python packaging service, they dropped support for PGP. Now, when you download my library, there really isn't any practical way that you can verify what you actually downloaded. You're purely trusting this packaging service with no authentication.
Got a bootstrapping problem.
Like no logging of what they're doing. It's nuts. It's completely nuts. And we're going backwards. I mean, if I was to go point somewhere and say, I think this is NSA action, I would actually point to the demonization of PGP. That's one of the most suspicious things in computer security right now. And unfortunately, it's working.
And how can you avoid those things? I mean, what would you advise to a normal guy just trying to have and own some Bitcoins in a safe way without like being victim of those issues?
For the layman, you know, they can go learn more. But I'm really talking more to the developers and the people who are kind of working as sysadmins. You know, if you don't understand PGP, but you are developing cryptography software, what are you doing with your life? Like, you know, I have a PGP key, I use it. Like, that is just table stakes to get involved in this stuff. You know, even if all you do is act as a sysadmin for like a Bitcoin exchange, if you are not checking packages and downloads with PGP, you are just really bad at your job. And you really have no excuse for this. And unfortunately, we're seeing tons of people in the computer security industry just demonize PGP as though it's like some terrible thing that will somehow make you less secure. And it's just not. It's the only really good thing we have to verify software provenance.
Okay. is it spamming the blockchain right now like an attack vector for Bitcoin or not? No?
No, I mean, at least, you know, Bitcoin has been designed to absorb, you know, quote unquote attacks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, calling it an attack is also a subjective thing. Obviously, we impose economic costs upon anyone who wants block space. So if you're using block space in a way that is inefficient or that is basically economically not very valuable, then, you know, the economics of the system will play out over time. You know, some people like to look at 2017 era when there was a lot of odd activity that some suspected may have been a attack, you know, to try to push the scaling debate in one direction or the other. And if that was the case, they failed and they spent a lot of money doing that and basically paid the miners a lot of money for the privilege of doing that. So, you know, I'm not worried about that particular mechanism.
Spamming Bitcoin blockchain. You have wondered what would support Bitcoin security after block subsidy will end. Well, inscriptions.
I mean, I'm certainly worried about the long term, but that's like 10 years off. Certainly for the now, I think what's happened with these so-called spam attacks is really more like an immune response. And I don't mean that in a good way. I mean, like, our immune response to that has been way overactive. And frankly, you know, had a bunch of Bitcoin, quote unquote, maxis not gotten all crazy about inscriptions, I don't think they really would have been a thing. We were giving them free advertising by getting all bent out of shape over this on Twitter and other social media. You know, that was free advertising for them. That made them much more popular than they would have otherwise been. Had everyone just ignored them, fees would have gone up a little bit. People would have got bored of it. Fees would have gone down. Instead, fees went way up, and they went mostly way down. And, you know, we did not need that big spike of interest. That was purely our own fault.
And what about, like, adding illegal content on the blockchain? I mean, can it be used on a political way, and like to say you can't use Bitcoin because now it contains something illegal? You
know? People have already tried to go pull this angle years ago, and it never got traction.
It worked really well against BitTorrent.
Yeah.
BitTorrent's totally dead now because of all the illegal content.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, in theory, it could be an issue, but like there, it's a legal question. And the nice thing about that scenario is there are other services like certificate transparency, where if, you know, putting illegal content in the Bitcoin chain is bad, people can do the exact same thing, certificate transparency, which, you know, literally every single person in this room uses that as a blockchain to go verify HTTPS certificates. It's by far the biggest use of blockchain. It dwarfs Bitcoin, dwarfs Ethereum, dwarfs all the stuff. And yet it still has that same vulnerability. And I would love to see someone go try that just to see what the immune response would be. And I'm sure, you know, laws will have to just accept that. Well, you know, it's a data publication mechanism. Like, treating that as, oh, everything must be shut down is ludicrous.
Andrei, what's the point of view about it?
Well, it definitely will be used against Bitcoin users when the courts and the police will get the orders. It's just recall how gold was banned in the United States. If they will find gold bullion in your house, you are under criminal charges. Same way, if they would find illegal content on Bitcoin blockchain that was downloaded on your notebook, you would be held liable, and most likely there will be a few public cases just to scare off people. Will it be successful in the end? Of course, no. But will this be used as an attack vector? Definitely yes.
Okay, I would like to say just three words, okay? Quantum computing is. In the context of Bitcoin, and I'll let you like to finish the phrase, quantum computer is?
Probably bullshit.
Okay.
I used to, like, prior to being involved in Bitcoin, I used to work in gravity radiometry, and I had a lot of coworkers who were extremely good physicists, including quantum nuttiness, and I think the simple answer is, it appears that as you scale quantum computers up and add more qubits, the cost of the computer goes up exponentially because you got to work harder and harder and harder to keep the quantum states from decomposing, basically. And that, you know, that makes intuitive sense. If quantum computers were real, they would be like analog computers. And we all know that if you have true analog computers, you can break all kinds of crazy math. And it looks like physics doesn't actually work that way. All this stuff about infinite resolution, quantum fields, it probably isn't how the world actually works. And the cool thing is, maybe in the process of building quantum computers, we'll find new physics. We'll find out why they don't work. And that will probably be a brand new branch of physics, understanding why quantum computers don't actually work.
Well, I mean, on the bright side, Bitcoin is actually probably one of the biggest bug bounties, when it comes to solving quantum computing, or at least, if you had a quantum computer with sufficient qubits, there's a wide variety of things that you could attack, but it would probably make sense to start mining some of those early pay-to-pub key Bitcoin blocks, and this would be noticeable, of course. So, you could claim that as long as we're not seeing massive odd activity of spins from those first couple of years of Bitcoin mined blocks, that that's probably good evidence that a quantum computer with sufficient capacity does not currently exist. Now, is it worth talking about how to harden Bitcoin against that? Maybe. I can't think of any way, though, that we would be able to protect those early pay-to-pub key UTXOs without breaking the original owner's ability to spend that money. So it would certainly be an extremely controversial change if we wanted to, quote-unquote, protect all of the Bitcoin against quantum computing.
So for you, quantum computing is?
A fascinating problem.
Irrelevant. Quantum computer is irrelevant. I also have quite good familiarity with quantum mechanics and quantum chemistry, and it would be extremely difficult and expensive to build actually a useful quantum computer. And if you will would build it, you would better spend it, use it to mine Bitcoin, not to break old keys. Mm-hmm.
And as a reminder, all the stuff you hear about things like D-Wave, they are not the type of quantum computer that has anything to do with cryptography. That's an entirely separate class. So for the most part, all the press releases you hear about, Google having a quantum computer, that's actually not relevant to Bitcoin.
Okay, let's talk about like network attacks and attacks on privacy. So in my point of view, I think that that's something not good at all, I think, but I feel like the Bitcoin network right now is being split in two different like UTXOs and users. Like know your customer users and know your transactions user, and like cypherpunks who doesn't follow like these things, they coin join, they want to do swaps and this. So do you think that the attacks on privacy in the long term will be like an attack vector for Bitcoin or not? I mean, is that a non-existent user issue, or is it real?
In general, I'm unfortunately very bearish on both security and privacy, just from observing human actions and incentives, and it just seems like I think it's a fair statement to say the average person doesn't care about privacy or security until it's too late.
Yeah.
And I don't really have a solution for that. I mean, humans are complicated creatures, and we all have busy lives and our own priorities, and generally privacy and security are nowhere near the top because we're just focused on more day-to-day issues. So, I think the general state of privacy in Bitcoin is pretty terrible. And in order to actually achieve decent privacy on Bitcoin, you have to be willing to put in a lot of effort. So it's certainly possible, but I think the sort of proportion of people who will be willing to put in the effort is just infinitesimally small.
But don't you think that maybe in the future these two kind of like users will not be able to communicate and do transactions to each other?
I mean, as it stands today, it seems like the hardcore pro-privacy people are more likely to essentially get themselves locked out of the traditional on-ramps and off-ramps in the system. And maybe that's okay. If you're living a pure Bitcoin lifestyle and doing circular economy within Bitcoin, you don't have to worry about getting censored by third-party customers.
Yeah, but that's a small part of it.
It is, unfortunately.
But keep in mind, you're actually talking about as though the UTXO set splits.
No,
but that's not really how it would work, right? If I am this pro-privacy guy, I will happily accept your KYC coins.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not relevant to me where they came from. I don't care. It's only relevant if I try to send them, say, your exchange or something. Now, you might choose to be locked into a service where you cannot send your coins at all. Although, I don't think that's a likely attack, because that kind of politics doesn't like the ability to own Bitcoin at all. I mean, it doesn't like the ability to own things. You know, there is, unrelated, like, well, somewhat unrelated Bitcoin itself. I mean, there are political proposals to have asset registries. So the idea is anything of value you own with non-trivial value, like an example, like, your phone, would be required to be on an asset registry to ensure that the government knew at all time exactly how much stuff you own. You know, those are serious political proposals that people are trying to go push. And I think in that world, from that point of view, Bitcoin is just so unacceptable. It's not like there will be a split of Bitcoin. It's that for those people, Bitcoin just should not exist. Whereas I would say for the less extreme world, the fact that Bitcoin privacy can be, but isn't always, bad, has actually allowed Bitcoin to navigate some of the politics in ways that things like Monero can't. You know, Monero keeps on getting delisted on exchanges because it's too private. Whereas Bitcoin can kind of do this weird fig leaf dance where it's like, no, it's, you can see what's on chain. Although at the same time, I can easily just install Wasabi and get very good privacy on my coins. Or I can go send you with Lightning and get extremely good privacy under most threat models. You know, if I go send you with money with Lightning, you really have no idea where it came from. And it's very difficult to figure that out. But you can play the stance of, well, no, it's on the chain some of the time, and just track it.
Yeah, but like most, like the biggest nodes in Lightning Network are being controlled by an entity, and you can put pressure on that entity not to like communicate with other. I mean, imagine
but
that.
But the moment that happens, people can immediately start running other Lightning nodes. I mean, the bigger threat is not the putting pressure on it. The bigger threat is them doing surveillance of the incoming and outgoing Lightning payments and then trying to go piece that together. But there is so much Lightning capacity from so many entities that you can easily add modes to Lightning Wall to route around, you know, bigger entities. Also, I mean, you know, even if I pay through, say, Bitfinex, and let's suppose hypothetically that Bitfinex has been forced or stolen all their transaction data, that's still good privacy because the way Lightning works is it's onion routing. So if you lose that privacy on, say, the Bitfinex node, all of the other nodes before and after still provide privacy. You know, it's just exceptionally difficult for attackers to attack Lightning without putting a lot of efforts into it, which is certainly not true of on-chain Bitcoin without CoinJoin.
Is it an attack vector on Bitcoin?
No.
But it is very heavy attack vector on Bitcoin usability. You can happily live in a poor Bitcoin economy, but at the moment it is very teeny. And if you will actually try to live only on Bitcoin and try to make sure that your suppliers also use only Bitcoin, you will quickly find that your life becomes unlivable and unmanageable. So unless you will be able to exchange you or somebody in your supply chain will be able to exchange Bitcoin into fiat to pay out for their supplies or their credit, tough luck. And if exchanges will just be forced to accept only KYC coins, so the only solution for Bitcoin usability to improve is within a few years drastically increase the number of businesses that not just use Bitcoin as payment rails and immediately sell out into the dollars or euro, but that quote prices in Bitcoin and do accounting in Bitcoin and do investment in Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, I mean, on the bright side, we are seeing more development. Like the Fediment basically has some interesting privacy properties. Mm-hmm. I think Arc has some interesting privacy properties. So, you know, it's the game is not over. The game is still afoot. And we will continue to have people developing better options.
I mean, I got to say, though, I am much more concerned about the war on cash. Bitcoin can do its own thing. The war on cash is the thing that has to be stopped. And frankly, everyone in this audience, if you don't use cash to go pay regularly, I don't respect you as a Bitcoiner. Like, that's just a fact. If you're using credit every single day, fuck you. The war on cash is far more important than Bitcoin.
So we have around like 2 minutes remaining, and I would like to ask something from you. What is your biggest fear about Bitcoin and why?
Well, I would say my biggest fear is that we don't achieve the level of scalability that we would like to see. You know, there are a number of different options out there, and I think we need to keep exploring more and more. There's this open question, you know, obviously right now it's not even physically possible to get a UTXO into the hands of even 100 million, a billion people, like in a meaningful time frame. And so I think there's this open question of like, what does mass adoption actually look like? And, you know, I'm sure we'll get to fight over that in the coming years.
My biggest fear is PSYOPs. Just to mention, if there would be a semi-coordinated activity between states to do something like it was around COVID hysteria, but about Bitcoin. So Bitcoin will be dirty, gangster money, and it kills babies, and everyone suddenly would believe it. Sorry, but people and mass are stupid, and they will believe if they would be told it 24/7. So that's my biggest fear.
Well, remember, I mean, I don't really care about Bitcoin per se as much as the ability to go and use cryptocurrencies in general. You know, Bitcoin happens to be the biggest and will probably remain so. But, you know, if to scale to like 10 billion people, a couple other cryptocurrencies pop up and, you know, that's fine. But I'm much more concerned again about the war on cash. Like the general wars on privacy we have, that's the biggest threat to Bitcoin. If Bitcoin scales to a billion people and like five other coins take up the slack, whatever, I'm not too worried about that. That's a perfectly good opportunity. But we have to be in a position politically where that's even possible. And if we lose the ability to go pay anonymously in fiat currencies, we are so screwed. And unfortunately, that is what governments want.
Okay. I think that the public has some questions for you. We will have like a 15-minute Q&A session. So if I'm not wrong, you should be able to scan like a QR code somewhere around here, and you can ask something to Peter, Andrew, and Jameson. So yeah. You know, it's really difficult to choose the right ones, actually. Okay, well, let's start from this one. So SHA 256, is it like safe in the long term?
Well, nothing is safe forever, right?
Yeah.
Now, I don't think anyone is worried about SHA-256 being broken anytime in the near future, but you know, all cryptography degrades and is eventually broken.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think it's quite possible in my entire lifetime, SHA-256 is never broken. Sometimes in tech, we solve problems and actually get to the limit of what is possible. It's probably true that cryptography can exist, and there's a reasonable chance we've actually succeeded.
This is a good question because I don't know if you know about Purism. It's like a company that is producing like security and privacy focused hardware. And they are asking like, what about using anti-interdiction techniques similar to Purism for shipping hardware security devices? So, you know, like all the, like imagine all the anti-interdictions features.
So to explain, I mean, what they're talking about is basically ways of shipping things in containers that are tamper evident.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. I mean,
the
famous example is like you go put glitter on something, and as it turns out, getting glitter to recreate more glitter is really difficult.
Yeah.
Because glitter is very fine. And I mean, I think that's all good. I think the big, you know, and I certainly would say a lot of companies do not do this right. You know, they do really silly things like they'll say put holograms on something, but they don't tell you on the website what the hologram should look like.
Yeah.
So someone can trivially peel it off or replace it with a different one. You never notice. So, you know, Purism, I like what they're doing, but I just wish more people did it. But it also cautioned people, this isn't a perfect solution. You know, Purism, their own factories could be receiving stuff that's backdoored. Mm-hmm. People can backdoor stuff at the factory. You know, more people should do it, but it doesn't solve everything.
Something that they do, for example, is that they put the glitter on the screws.
Yep.
They take a picture.
Yep.
They encrypt. They save that picture and they send it to you.
Yep.
With your they encrypt it and they send it to you by email just after you receive the package,
yep.
And you can check, you know, like if the glitter is the same.
Yep.
So yeah, it's cool. It's like a paranoia mode. But
yeah. There's an
app
for this actually called Blink Comparator, which will save an image of something like that, and you can just easily switch between the image and your camera to see if anything's changed. unfortunately, the app's kind of broken because like not many people actually do this, but someone should fix this stuff and make it easy. Like, and I'll point out, seriously, this is actually how nuclear weapon security works in a lot of cases. You know, nuclear weapons are actually secured in transit using these kinds of techniques.
So, do Satoshis and lost UTXOs with revealed public keys pose a systemic risk for Bitcoin? Let us pretend that quantum computers will be real in the future. So, we were talking about it already, man.
Yeah. I mean, if that happens, well, it's not only Satoshi's coins, really. It's any UTXO that has ever exposed the public key. So, this is one reason why address reuse is discouraged. But let's be honest, a lot of people reuse addresses. I bet some of those like top 50 whale addresses that belong to exchanges and stuff have been reused like crazy. So a quantum computing attacker would actually probably go after them first before the like Satoshi era coins. What are you going to do about it though? You know, unless it was some sort of forced upgrade that essentially, you know, breaks all of the quantum computing, you know, UTXOs that have public keys in them. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's,
well, I mean, worst comes to worst. I remember I looked up this number recently, and something like at most maybe 10-20% of all coins in circulation appear to be lost. And by the definition of they haven't moved for like 5+ years. Well, think about it this way. If the economics works the way we think it does, if 10% of the coins get stolen and redistributed, the price in theory should go down on the order of 10-ish%, 50%, something like that, roughly. I mean, that's happened before. It's not really a big deal. And if we do decide to do a soft fork to go see, you know, hold those coins in place, well, you could do that too. I mean, you could do a soft fork that expires in 10 years. Maybe someone will find a clever math trick to let you bypass this problem and let the coins be spent another way. I don't really know. And honestly, I'm not that worried, because the really important thing with all this is that quantum computer resistant signature algorithms do appear to exist. And Bitcoin can upgrade to new signature algorithms. It's not that hard. It can be done in a soft fork. And, you know, when you do that, people can move their coins on. Of course, obviously, if an alien drops by with a quantum computer that breaks everything tomorrow, we might be screwed, but Bitcoin might be the least of our worries. Like, everything will break.
Yeah.
All of computer security will break all at once.
There's another question for you, Peter. So, do you see any chance to win the war on cash, and how?
Sorry, what?
So, if you see any chance to win the war on cash?
Oh, yeah.
And how?
Oh, absolutely. It's a public opinion thing, and there are countries where cash usage is actually going up. Germany, I believe, is an example of this. And, you know, like anything, you have to go and win it with politics. You have to go convince people this is politically important. You know, in the U.S., gun laws are getting better decade after decade because of massive political efforts to make gun freedoms more free. This stuff works, at least in democratic countries. Now, you know, if you're in China, well, I hate to tell you, but you may be screwed and there'll be nothing that will ever work, mm-hmm. You know. But fortunately, most of the people in this audience are in places that are reasonably democratic and you can play politics with this. And the thing I always tell people is, like, there's this idea that cypherpunks write code. And that's all well and good, but these things are synergistic. Bitcoin gives us abilities so we don't have to purely rely on politics, but Bitcoin's not perfect. Crypto isn't perfect. You also need to play the political game to take advantage of the gains you have here and vice versa. And we really need people doing both at once for all this stuff, be it Bitcoin, be it cash, you know, be it being allowed to have end-to-end encryption. I mean, the EU would very much like, at least some elements of the EU bureaucracy would very much like to ban end-to-end encryption. And we need concerted efforts politically to make sure they don't ban it. Because even though you can still run the code, having so fewer people use it is still a massive loss.
And this is where I have to disagree with Peter, because I'm so bearish on privacy. I don't think you... The question is, though, how many people care about privacy? Because you could argue that you only need like a couple percent of people to be like advocates for something.
Apple has end-to-end encryption on messaging, and obviously people cared enough to go and install it, and Apple cared enough. So I'm bearish, but I'm not that bearish.
And I would disagree about political part. Once again, as you have mentioned, most of people in this audience live in Western democracies, and Western countries are let's say it, pretty rich. You haven't seen how politics works in countries where that are poor, and therefore state is also poor. Meanwhile, I was involved in lawmaking since 2001 or two, I don't remember. Such activity in small and not very wealthy country looks like, yes, guys, you can come to us, you can talk, we can discuss forever, whatever you would like. But everything was already decided, and the law is already written, and anything you will like to change will be just thrown into the trash.
Well, remember, so, I'm from Canada. Canada is full of immigrants who have come from terrible countries with terrible politics, and they move to a place with better politics. You know, these things can change. Often these things get a lot worse, and people have some amount of choice. You know, it's not perfect, it's not terrible.
Sorry, my point is not that countries say everybody should move to Canada, but since in Western democracies there is state, and state makes each country less wealthy, and state can only grow. Therefore, even Western countries become more and more poor as time goes. So you will just see the same behavior from your state as time will go.
Well, I can't agree things consistently get worse. There are plenty of counterexamples.
Let's save it for another day.
Jameson, a question for you. Is running like my own like Lightning Node better for privacy?
Running your own Lightning Node?
Yeah.
Certainly. You know, as Peter said, you know, there is an onion routing protocol. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of one of the unknowns, though. Like, what we do know, I believe Chainalysis published something recently saying that they were like getting into Lightning Network analysis. We don't know what they're doing, but it's a question of like how many hops is your payment making. So, you know, if you're in Peter's example, if you have a node and you're connected directly to Bitfinex or, you know, whatever other provider, and you're just sending directly to them, they have a reasonably good idea where it's coming from, especially if it's like associated with some other account that you're using. If you're hopping through, you know, multiple different nodes, you know, they can only know, you know, one hop before, yeah, one hop after. But, you know, unfortunately, there is no perfect aspect to all of this. You know, if you wanted to be really paranoid, you might want to even, you know, limit incoming channels to your, yeah, node, and be much more, I guess, meticulous about which nodes you connect to so that you don't, you know, accidentally connect to a surveillance node.
But a big problem with limiting incoming nodes is, remember, plausible deniability is a thing. If it is known that your node accepts incoming connections, that does make it harder to go figure out for the next hop whether or not it's you or someone else. And in fact, you ideally want to, you know, if you're going to use Lightning in this way, you ideally want a node that's very busy with tons of routing going through it so that there's basically a whole lot of cover traffic. You know, your K and NIMDY sets of what transactions could be yours or could be others. The more transactions other people send through your node, the better.
I think one of the unfortunate things that I and many other people have found over the past few years is that Lightning has not worked very well over Tor, especially as, yeah, Tor itself has come under attack. So hopefully we'll see some alternatives there. It's not great that, you know, in order to use Lightning well, you're pretty much relegated to using it over ClearNet.
You know, I think that there's also like an educational issue here, because most of the people that are opening channels to the same and same nodes every time, and while we should even start like telling people, look, you don't have to open a channel to the biggest node to have a better network reach, right? You can like basically achieve the same result by opening it to a newer node and to a smaller node probably. And maybe it can help, you know, on the privacy level.
Of course, I do also need to point out, I mean, when Chainalysis says they can do something, you know, I've personally, well, I have a funny story where I managed to go speak to a CEO of a competitor to Chainalysis. and they were drunk enough that they admitted to me, oh yeah, our server is basically fraud. You know, we don't actually have the ability to do all this analysis. We're just selling it to exchanges that don't care, and we're selling it to police who don't care either because they already know who they wanted to arrest. So, you know, is Chainalysis like that too? It wouldn't surprise me. I don't know because I don't, you know, I don't work for them. I don't have access to their internal data, but it would not surprise me if they've oversold their capabilities. And we do, there is a lawsuit, a criminal case, I should say, going on right now where Chainalysis is extremely relevant, and it's looking like the Chainalysis data is just wrong and they picked the wrong guy. So, you know, we can't know this stuff for sure, but I wouldn't take what they say at face value.
Do you believe in Bitcoin-based future for all or just a niche tool for able individuals?
That's almost a scaling question, yeah. At least in my mind. You know, or is it like a hyper-Bitcoinization? You know, when is that going to happen?
Many, many years from now.
I mean, it's not impossible, but I wouldn't say it's the most likely thing within, say, the next 20 years. You know, the world economy is just very big, and it takes a lot to go shift that. But could Bitcoin act as something that large numbers of people have in addition to fiat currency? I think that's a very likely outcome, and we've already seen that. You know, if you go ask like a country like Canada and poll people on who owns cryptocurrencies, I think the number is like 10-20% now, which is enormous impact.
Well,
Bitcoin okay. Future is only one because fiat currencies die and the state dies with them.
We've got that going for us.
Well, guys, thanks for your participation. I think it was a really great panel. And yeah,
thank
Jameson, you. Andre, and Peter.